I'm Mary Nichols, Dean of the College of Continuing Education, and it's my great pleasure to welcome you to tonight's forum on the environment. John Foley, whom I'm so pleased to introduce, joined the University of Minnesota faculty just last August as the director of the Institute on the Environment and a McKnight Presidential Chair in Ecology, Evolution, and Behavior. Prior to coming to Minnesota, he spent 15 years in Wisconsin at Madison, where he founded the Center for Sustainability and the Global Environment, which he founded to bring researchers together to work on the world's pressing environmental issues. For the last several years, his research has focused on the interaction between land use and global climate patterns, which will become the foundation of a project he's launching at the Institute on the Environment called Global Landscapes Initiative. Professor Foley has received numerous honors for his important work, including the J.S. McDonnell Foundation's 21st Century Science Award and the Sustainability Science Award from the Ecological Society of America. And in 1997, President Clinton awarded him the Presidential Early Career Award for Scientists and Engineers. So please join me in welcoming tonight Professor John Foley.
Well, thank you very much for having me here tonight. It's really great to be here in Minnesota and be in such a warm and receiving crowd like this. It's just fantastic. And they were originally asking me to do this event in January, which I'm glad I didn't do, because not only was it a lot colder, but I also had turned out to have a raging case of adult chicken pox, which I would not recommend anyone getting. So, yeah, it wasn't any fun. You would not have wanted me that night. So this worked really well. So, well, thanks for having me here again tonight. And I really just want to have a conversation with you. I'm really glad we're getting more time at the end for questions and answers. But to start this conversation, to really talk about this question of sustainability, how are we going to live through this century in a way that is something we'll be proud of, something we'll leave behind for future generations, and deal with this challenge of what I call living on a shrinking planet? This idea of living in a shrinking planet is just this. It's reflecting in our moment in history. Throughout human history, we have been very small, that is us, the civilization, and the Earth has been unimaginably large. We literally had dragons at the edges of our maps. There were always new frontiers and new resources and new places to go. And recently, almost at the drop of a hat in terms of the broad stretch of history, that has fundamentally changed. And it has changed for two fundamental reasons. One, of course, is that we as a species have been pretty prolific, and we've grown tremendously in population, like this, going along and along and along. But suddenly, during the Industrial Revolution, we see this explosion of humanity from maybe 500 million people to today, close to 7 billion, and soon close to 9. So we have dramatically increased in the number of people in the world very, very recently. But not only are we more people, we are now a technological people. This picture is taken by spy satellites and defense satellites, actually, looking at the sky of the Earth at night. This is what aliens would see if they came looking at our planet at nighttime. And we see the lights of our cities and the lights of our cars and all of these things scattered around the world, shouting to the rest of the solar system that we are now a technological species. So there are many more of us with rapidly changing technologies. And this shrinking planet, if you will, has meant that in the last just blink of an eye of our history, we've seen, for example, just between 1950 and 2000, only 50 years, population more than doubles, outpacing all of the generations of humans ever combined. More than that, our economy grew sevenfold, adjusted for inflation. The goods and services and stuff we buy and sell increased sevenfold. So we got twice as many people, seven times more stuff being bought and sold. And this is having tremendous pressure on our natural resources, whether it be agriculture, which roughly tripled in the consumption of water and food in the last 50 years, or energy, which quadrupled in its intensity in the last 50 years. We have outpaced all living human beings for something like 3 million years in the last 50 and did it again several more times. That's an extraordinary moment to be alive, less than a human lifespan, and that's the time which we have inherited. And it's a time where we're taking our planet and literally pushing it to its limits in almost every conceivable way. Now, you may first think that I'm going to talk about climate change, because that's one of the big issues where, you know, see a picture of clouds and stuff, too. You're going to think climate change. Well, that's one of the big issues, and I'll certainly touch upon it. But we also need to look at other big environmental issues, and maybe the most obvious is the landscape around us, how we use land. This is a photo taken from the Brazilian Amazon, from a place I actually do quite a bit of work in the eastern part of the Amazon called Pará. This is a landscape where it's just cut down and burned down, and pretty soon it's going to be a cattle pasture. And a couple of years after that, once the land is leveled out and they can plow it up a little bit more, it'll be probably turned into a soybean field, where those soybeans will probably be exported to Europe or China for animal feed to feed cows. So that's a pretty big change, but when you step back and look from outer space, for example, we can see a landscape in the Amazon near Bolivia. Here it is in 1975, what it looks like. And then we look again more recently, and it's been fundamentally cleared. It looks much more like Iowa, frankly. And these are all soybean plantations, believe it or not. So it looks a lot like Iowa. And so this is actually a tremendous change in what was virgin rainforest. In less than 20 years or so, it turns into a major agricultural global export commodity marketplace for the world. The pace of this change is extraordinary and unlike anything else in history. And land use is not just a local issue, it's a local issue everywhere in the world. If we look globally, this is work that my group has done over the years. On the top map, I won't geek out with all the science behind this, but the top map tells you where in the world do we grow crops. The darker the color, the more of the landscape is being used to grow crops, corn, soybean, wheat, rice, etc. Down below is basically where we grow cows, the world's pastures and rangelands where we let our animals hang out and graze and that kind of thing. Pastures and rangelands are the largest ecosystem on the earth today, much larger than rainforest or the boreal forest or the Arctic. It's huge. And if we put all this together, we find that we use about 3 million square kilometers of land in cities, or something about the size of Belgium. We have about a South America's worth of land in crops, and about an Africa's worth of land in pastures. And you put all that together, that's 40% of all of the land on Earth we have cleared. And the other 60%, much of it we influence in other ways. This is extraordinary. No other time in Earth's history has ever seen the domination of land by one species to this extent. Unbelievable. So land use is huge and a global, global issue. And along with it, of course, we use a tremendous amount of water. This is a photo taken out of an airplane window flying into Phoenix. This is looking at an agricultural landscape in Arizona. You can see all the irrigation feeding this desert landscape so that it can grow something. I found out later that it's probably iceberg lettuce. And I can't help but think that's probably iceberg lettuce being shipped to Minnesota to buy in our supermarkets, where we could probably go some of that of ourselves, at least in the summer. Well, where does this water come from? Well, this is in the Colorado River Basin of Western North America, Western U.S., and the Colorado looked like this in the 1950s. So on a typical day, this is just sort of an average flow of the Colorado in the 50s. This is more what it looks like today on a typical day. That difference is to help do things like grow lettuce in the desert or grow cities like Las Vegas, etc. That's a pretty big difference. By the way, as a little side note, I'd get over to the Science Museum of Minnesota because they have a fantastic exhibit about this part of the world and the use of water everywhere. Really great and tells the story very, very well. But a place where the story of water is even more extreme is the former Soviet Union, the Aral Sea. This used to be one of the world's great inland seas. This is a large, much bigger than a lot of the Great Lakes, inland sea, a picture of it in the 1970s. And this is a sea surrounded by desert. It shouldn't be there. There's no rainfall there, really. But it's fed by two little rivers that drain snowmelt from mountains far, far, far to the east. So snow melts up in the mountains, it trickles down these rivers and feeds this inland sea in the middle of the desert of the Soviet Union. Well, Khrushchev and others actually back in the 50s started an idea of like, well, if we diverted those rivers, we could use that water to irrigate the desert and grow things like cotton and export that to the world and bring cash into the Soviet Union, which is badly needed. So they went ahead and did that. But, you know, it doesn't take rocket science to figure out what would happen to the Aral Sea if you take away the water supply. Well, this is what happens. This is it in the 1980s, closer to the 1990s, and this is the early 2000s. Now, imagine that the edge of the Aral Sea is Lake Superior. and your lakefront home up at Lake of Superior is there. And in 30 years or less, the lake moved about 80 to 100 miles inland. Well, you'd be pretty pissed, first of all. But second of all, sorry. It would have pretty big implications, of course, for, you know, your industries, fishing, your even your weather patterns would fundamentally change. Everything would be different. Just imagine that. Well, to bring this home, this is a picture that Al Gore gave me once, a picture he took back when he was in the U.S. Senate visiting the Soviet Union. This is the Aral Sea. These were canals they desperately dug to float fishing fleets to keep up with a retreating shoreline. They literally couldn't move piers and buoys and such fast enough to keep up with a bloody shoreline. And they basically had to abandon these ghost fleets in the desert of what used to be the Aral Sea. Now, I can't help to think, but archaeologists in the future are going to dig this up and wonder what we were thinking. You know, what is the deal with these people? And this is not an isolated event. This is happening all over the world. We are doing drastic things. We use about 50% of the fresh water that flows across the Earth's surface, mostly for growing food. 85% of the water we use is to grow food. Bottled water and all that is an issue, but food is the big elephant in the room when it comes to water. Irrigation, 85% of all the water goes there. So that's huge, and we use 50% of every drop of water that flows across the Earth's surface today. What about the other 50%? So water problems, not just the quantity of water, but certainly the quality of it, are becoming huge issues all over the world. And we certainly know that in Minnesota, too. So we have land use, water use, and maybe the use of our air itself. Now, the atmosphere is so funny. Now, you go outside and you look up, and it looks infinite because we're kind of short. You know, we look up into the atmosphere. But the atmosphere is not infinite. It's only about 6 miles thick is the lower atmosphere, what we call the troposphere. That's where all of our weather happens. That's where all of our oxygen is. That's where all of the water we use comes from. Everything happens in that lower 6 miles or so. That's just a subway ride. That's from like the Statue of Liberty to Central Park. You're out of the atmosphere already. It doesn't take much to change that very thin layer. And I'm not going to bore you with the whole global warming story. I'm sure you've all heard this many, many times before. But to bring it home, this is really happening, folks. This is just basic physics. There's absolutely no mystery behind it. The science of global climate change has been known for over 120 years. I can get into that later in the Q&A if you want. And we see the evidence of it in our very eyes every single day. This is a glacier named after John Muir, photographed here in the 1940s. We have to redraw the map because now it's Muir Lake in just 60 years. What's even more startling to me is that what used to be bedrock and, you know, nothing growing on it, not even lichen, is now a small forest growing in the foreground. That's geologically unprecedented rates of change. That doesn't happen on this planet. It's not supposed to. Something really weird is going on. So this is extraordinary. So what I'm trying to get across here is that it's not just climate change. We, in fact, have a litany of big environmental problems. Of course, global warming. But we also have huge problems connected to our use of land, whether it's deforestation or degrading our soils and whatnot here in Minnesota. It's overdrafting and polluting our global water supplies. And I didn't even mention biodiversity. We are now in the sixth great extinction event in our planet's history. The last one was 65 million years ago when the dinosaurs went bye-bye. Well, we're now in the middle of the sixth great extinction event caused by us. And not only are we losing tremendous numbers of species, we're actually creating more or less new ones through accelerating the pressures on bacteria and viruses that are coming out and new novel biological pests and disease that we're creating through our land use and other things. Absolutely extraordinary. And what keeps me up at night, it's hard to keep up, keep an environmental scientist up at night. We're kind of doom and gloom folks, if you haven't figured that out already. I've finally figured out why I never get invited to parties anymore. Well, never more than once. But to keep me up at night, it's not global warming or deforestation. I got a pretty thick skin now. It's really what we don't know. And what we don't know is what happens when all this stuff hits the fan at the same time. What does it mean to have a newly evolving virus in the tropical rainforest of the Amazon that's being clear-cut while climates are changing and we're connecting that to international markets through airline travel where you can be anywhere in the world in 24 hours? What does that mean? We have absolutely no idea what it means. the greatest environmental problems of our lifetime are probably the ones we haven't discovered yet. And that's kind of scary, to be honest. So that's what keeps me up at night a little bit. And this is an unprecedented challenge. This is fundamentally different than the way we thought about the environment in the 70s and the 80s. We really have to address the fact these are massive global problems. Entire regions of our world, whether it's the whole rainforest, all of the world's coral reefs, the Arctic, could literally be wiped off the map in our lifetime. That is not a stretch at all. That could really happen. So this is something fundamentally different. It affects billions of us all at once. Trillions of dollars of our economy are in play. This is huge, and it's unlike any problem we have ever dealt with as a civilization before. We've never tackled anything like this before. So how are we going to deal with it? It's also a world we don't want. And I want to get away from all this ideological stuff. I don't really care if you're Dick Cheney or Ralph Nader or anybody in between. It doesn't matter. Nobody wants, deliberately, nobody wants a world where we say, yeah, it's okay to make catastrophic impacts on our economy, our health, our national security, our very well-being. Nobody wants that. Nobody. And nobody certainly would want to visit those first and foremost on the world's poor and the world's children. But that's what's actually happening. Now, in the United States, we're so privileged, we're so lucky to be here. And it's sometimes easy for us to stick our heads in the sand and think this isn't really happening, it doesn't affect us. But of course it does. We are in a global economy, and we can certainly see that every day. We are in a global security environment. What happens in one part of the world affects us and our very lives. And of course, fundamentally, at the end of the day, it is also a moral issue. Is this the world that we are most proud of and the world that we think we should have? And that's a question we all have to answer ourselves at the end of the day. So this is a world we probably don't want. And it's a world we fundamentally need to change, and we need to change it soon. So that's the bad news. The good news is that, yeah, you know, we have to find some solutions here. Can we find them? And of course, the answer is an unquestionable yes. We absolutely can find the solutions to this problem. In fact, we're doing a lot of it right now. Not enough, but we're getting a lot started, and it's really, really getting accelerating into the future. We can get started on a lot of these issues today. Let me give you one example, energy. Right now, we know that we're doing a stupid way of energy, right? We know it's fundamentally dumb. We're buying fossil dinosaur stuff in old plants called oil that will run out. There's only so much of it on the planet. We're using it far faster than we're discovering new oil, right? Peak oil, you've all heard that idea. We're buying it from a lot of countries that aren't really friendly to us. We're borrowing money from the Chinese to send to the Middle East. You know, that's not very smart, is it? And then we burn this stuff in our cars, which causes air pollution, asthma, all sorts of problems, and possibly fundamental changes in our climate, which could disrupt everything that we do. That's pretty dumb. But it's a trillion-dollar industry, the biggest industry we've ever created, and it's fundamental to everything we do. So we're doing something pretty dumb, and it looks like, according to the Department of Energy, we're going to do more dumb stuff in the future. We're going to burn more carbon-based fuels. This is measuring the billions of tons of coal and oil and natural gas we burn. Instead of burning 1.8 billion tons, by 2050, they tell us we're going to burn 2.6. We're just going to get dumber. Well, I'm not sure we have to do that. What if we just use the technologies we have today in energy efficiency? Make sure we don't waste, literally by pouring it out the windows or in our lighting or heating, that kind of thing. What if we had just better efficiency with today's technology, no new inventions, just deploy what we can do today that's already economical, already feasible, and is shown to save money and create jobs? Electrical efficiency, heating and cooling efficiencies, just those two alone would cut our energy use that much and create jobs, keep money in America, and make our country more secure. Just like that. No problem at all. We could also do more with transportation. We could make passenger cars a little bit more efficient, maybe finally by 2050 catching up to the fuel efficiency of the second worst nation in the world for fuel efficiency is China. We are number one in that list, unfortunately. Our fuel efficiency is, what, 22 miles per gallon? China's is 35. They're the second worst. Europeans are somewhere in the 40s. Japan's somewhere in the low 40s. That's today. If we give us 40 years to catch up with where China is today for their fuel efficiency standards, and you wonder why we can't sell American cars, we could do that. I think we could do a lot more than that, but this is a modest first step. If we got to our trucks, our planes, our buses, and so on, we could do a little bit more. Hey, we're not only are we not increasing, we're already going down, and that's before we invent more renewable energy or things like carbon capture and storage, where we can burn American coal cleanly, hopefully, and capture that carbon before it disrupts our climate and bury it below ground, possibly. So what we can do here, these are all things that are going to make America more secure, more economically prosperous, have more jobs, and, oh yeah, as a benefit, maybe divert climate catastrophe. Sign me up. Let's go. This is pretty easy. The interesting thing is that there's no silver bullet. No one of these, even if we include ethanol, we include nuclear, we include wind, so you name it, none of them alone is the silver bullet solution that will solve all of our problems. But we sure as hell have silver buckshot. So let's use it. All right? We just put these things together and we get smart about it. We can do a lot. So I think we can step up not just to the energy challenge, but to the whole sustainability challenge we face. But it requires entirely new ways of thinking. We literally have to reinvent the world. We have to think entirely new ways about water. We have to think about new ways of producing food and our agricultural systems, and certainly around energy. And what's fantastic is Minnesota could lead the way. We are very good at all three of these things, okay, especially on this campus. And that's one of the reasons I came here. We're really, really strong in all three of these. And within 20 miles of this campus, there are 20 Fortune 500 companies who are very interested in all three of these things. We can lead the way. And guess what? We will. I'm convinced of it. One of the ways we're going to do that, and this is the blatant self-promotion part of the talk, is the this new thing we're creating. But I want to issue an invitation, too, to get involved with us. This new Institute on the Environment is not meant to be just, you know, we've done enough in the ivory tower. We can pat ourselves on the back and say, wow, we've discovered the stairwells inside the ivory tower that connect science and policy and the arts and everything else. But we're discovering the doors and the windows, too. We need to figure out how to connect to the business community, the NGO community, civil society here in Minnesota to really make a big difference in the world. And that's what this institute's all about. We're about tackling grand challenges to the world. These are the greatest challenges we face as a civilization. How do we find sustainable, secure, and economically reasonable solutions to energy, fresh water, food, etc.? The Institute is built around three big ideas. First, we say we have to discover entirely new solutions, radical new innovation. Break the mold, change the game. Ideas that have never been tried before have to be used in order to solve these grand challenges. That's one big thing we're about. We also have to prepare future leaders. It's not enough for us to prepare future scholars. The university is pretty good at that. We have to prepare future leaders, the next Al Gore, Larry Brilliant, John McCain, whoever you like. That's fine. Where are those people going to come from? I want them to come from Minnesota. I want them to come from this campus. I want them to be ringing out into the world, changing everything, but be, you know, something we are proud of, that we sent those folks out into the world. And the universities fundamentally have to change to do that. Programs like this are part of that solution, but we need to do a lot more, I think. And finally, we have to build much different kinds of partnerships. We have to work with business, with NGOs, with media and government on a day-to-day basis, not at the end of our research when we're publishing it in some journal, but on day one, helping us figure out what it is that we teach, what it is that we look to discover. And the Institute is going to work very hard to do that and work together to create what I call the Minnesota Agenda. How can we, in Minnesota, be the go-to place in the world for these solutions? How could we become the Silicon Valley for sustainability? How could we take Minnesota innovation and export it to the world while simultaneously creating jobs and economic opportunities here at home? That's what we're about. And I really, really invite you to get involved with this. And here's the website. I'll put it up at the end, too. But please, please get involved, because we cannot succeed without your help, without your input, without your ideas. Don't leave it to the academics to solve the problems. God, you know, that won't work, okay? We need your help desperately. So please, please get together with us. Because together, I really believe, as much as I'm a doom and gloom kind of guy, I'm actually a professional optimist. because I think together we should be able to boldly face this future. We have the greatest challenge in human history, but we also have the greatest opportunity in history to make the world a fundamentally better place. But it needs to be guided by two principles, and I'll leave you with these two thoughts in a minute here. The two principles that should guide us, I believe, are one, let's be in league with future generations. We should be partners with people who will live in the future. We should be the ones to get this started, to get moving in these solutions in the right direction and pass the baton to our children and grandchildren so they carry on this tradition and make this world a sustainable and humane and beautiful place that we all know and love. We need to do that. Now, for a lot of you in this room, a lot of you have children and grandchildren. It's easier for you to imagine a future generation. Maybe you're connected to some. But a lot of the time, a lot of my life, I've been teaching 18-year-olds who have a really hard time imagining this. So let me show you how I convince them about this. So what are these future generations? When you talk to a 20-year-old, 18-year-old, they have no idea what this means. But let me help you with that. This is a picture I used to keep above my desk in Madison for a long time. People from Sydney, Santiago, Rio, Amsterdam, Hong Kong. I'd show these to my students, and they'd say, wow, they're beautiful. They're like supermodels. Can you have their phone numbers? Do you have their email address? Or are they on Facebook? You know, I'd like to date that person. What's really interesting about these photos is that none of these people actually exist. This is a project called the Faces of Tomorrow Project. It's a guy who went around with a digital camera to Hong Kong, Amsterdam, Rio, and he just took hundreds and hundreds of photos of ordinary people on the street, brought them back to his studio and wrote a computer program that stitched them all together to look at the emergent face from within, the face from the crowd put together. So this literally is what humanity is going to look like in the future. This is who we are and who we can be. I don't know about you, but, you know, these are my clients. There's some of yours, too. I don't know, and I find this very inspiring and beautiful to know that these are the people we can be working for and this is the world we could have. So I really like this. So work with future generations, but along the way, always maintain the moral compass. The science that people like me do, the policy, the business, all that matters not at all unless we're also guided by a fundamental moral compass. And this is crucial, and scientists and policymakers alike have to recognize this. At the end of the day, what matters is the moral compass. And I'll just leave you with this one thought about that. We have been inheriting a defining moment in human history. None of us asked for that. None of us asked to be born in this moment. But this moment, at the climax of all this history coming together, is the moment that will determine the future of our planet. Not just for the next few years, but for the next several thousand years. What we do today will shape this planet for hundreds and thousands of years in the future. The rest of our species, perhaps, is going to be determined by people in this room and others like us. So given that defining moment, we're called upon, I hope, to be the best people we can possibly be and to make a fundamental choice because we still have this choice. And the choice is this. We can be the people we are or maybe the people we could be. We could have the world that is or we could create the world that should be. And I'd like to ask you to join me in making those things possible moving into the future. Thank you very much and I appreciate your time tonight. Please check out our website, and I look forward to all the conversation and Q&A here. Thank you so much for having me here tonight.
You know, I had doubts about coming to hear this because usually the subject is treated in a very different way. I congratulate you. I think that your message is wonderful.
Thank you.
But let me ask you a couple of questions.
But, yeah. I knew that was coming.
Twice now in my memory, quick memory, twice now, we have felt that the scientific community had the answer. One time they thought the world was flat. And they were wrong. Another time, closer to our time, Einstein turned Newton upside down.
Mm-hmm.
again, the scientists were all in agreement on one, and one came along and proved it wrong. This, my question to you is, are we actually allowing an opposite view to make a contribution to this whole question? The second question I have for you is, the solutions you suggest are all very logical. The only problem with it is that most of those we don't want in our own backyard. Yep. The solution to it requires that we act more like saints than human beings. How can we approach this? In a productive way, in your opinion.
All right. Well, good questions. Well, let me try to address the first one. Science is an iterative process. It's like democracy. Law and science are two of the most powerful instruments we've ever invented as democratic societies, because they acknowledge first and foremost there is never a single truth. That we're always iterating towards the truth. There's never a final destination in science or the law or how we govern ourselves. We can correct. And science at its best, and it's not always at its best, is a process by which we put out an idea and we try to look at it from every possible angle, and we look at it through the lens of evidence, data, scrutiny, and putting it into the public conversation. We don't hide it under a rock. We put it out there. In reports, articles, thousands of pages of science. And I invite people to get involved in that. You don't have to be an expert to scrutinize evidence. Now, like in the climate change debate, this is maybe one you were alluding to, I don't know. There's a vast scientific community that believes climate change is real. The basic physics of this have been known for over 120 years. Every single piece of evidence shows that the planet is indeed warming. There are still many questions to be answered. But on the other hand, we have so-called climate skeptics who say, well, we're not sure, we might have some doubts about this. And they get a lot of time on TV. Fair enough. I would ask you and myself as just, as good citizens of the state, of the country, and the world to say, show me the data. Let's say you're in a jury and you've got one lawyer who says, I've got the fingerprints, I've got the DNA, I've got I got an eyewitness, I've got the motive, I got everything, and here it is. I'll hand it all over in paper and reports to you. You can look at it. Versus the other guy who may be very charming, and he'll just say, oh, shucks, don't listen to that other lawyer. You don't need to worry about that. It's okay. And he'll tell you a bedtime story, but he hasn't shown you any evidence. So when these climate skeptics come up, I say, show me a single piece of evidence. One. Just one. In the last 15 years I've been working on this, not one of them has been able to stand up and show me one shred of evidence to back up their claims. It's a great story. I wish they were right. It'd be great if global warming turned out not to be an issue. I'd be really happy. Problem is, there's no data to back it up. Now, maybe they'll come up with something. Maybe we're all wrong. I hope to God that's true, but I really doubt it. So that's the first question. Hopefully I'm addressing it. The second one was more like, how do you get people to change a little bit to accept some of these things? Look, you know what? If we have to ask people to sacrifice their real well-being, I don't mean how much stuff they buy at the mall and all the crap we buy in our houses and throw away, is that making us happier and better off and more secure fundamentally? Not really. But if we're asking people to compromise their true quality of life, their ability to spend time with their family, to live in a nice place, to have food and water that's clean and secure and sustainable and healthy, if we ask people to sacrifice that to save the environment, screw it. I say don't bother. Don't do that. If we're smart enough, we should be able to do both. We should be able to make people better off, healthier, more economically prosperous, create jobs, and, help the environment be more sustainable. All it takes is a little bit of ingenuity and know-how, and people in Minnesota know how to do this. We roll up our sleeves and solve problems, not just whine about them. So I am actually quite an optimist about this. Now, sometimes people don't want a windmill in their backyard, that kind of thing. But, sorry, I don't mean to ramble on that. Let me tell you one little story about this. I think this would play in Minnesota too. This is a Wisconsin story. Sorry about that. But I was in up in the thumb of Wisconsin that juts out in Lake Michigan. There's Door County and a little county called Kewaunee County. There's a wind farm that was built by Madison Gas and Electric, the utility that I used to live in, their district. And they built a wind farm right out by Lake Michigan in a bunch of farmers' fields. I went out there and just checked it out. I didn't work for the company, but I was invited to go to the opening and see all this stuff. And I started talking to the farmers and saying, you know, do you mind having these things in your field? They're right next to your house. And first they said, God, no, this is helping us keep our family farm. I get a rent check from the power company every month, and I can count on it. It's the thing that makes the difference between me losing the farm and keeping the farm, a small but reliable source of income every day. And I can grow corn right up to the base of the thing, no problem. And the second one, this is the one I thought was pretty funny, is one guy, kind of, you know, an older gentleman, was saying, you know, ever since I put up that windmill in my backyard, I stopped watching television. And I just looked at him like, what do you mean? He said, yeah, you know, Ma and I just sit out here and watch the windmill. It's a hell of a lot better. Much better than cable, you know. And I was sitting there drinking a lemonade with him, and I'm watching this kind of mesmerizing little thing go by, and I'm, you know, you're right. You know? So these, you know, kind of eco-chic people living out in Nantucket who don't want windmills spoiling their view, I say stuff, you know, that's just ridiculous. We need to work together, and guess what? It may be a lot more pleasant than you think. I'm convinced the solutions to sustainability are going to be fun. They're going to be economically empowering to us. They'll create jobs, and if we just put our minds to it, these will be good for us in so many different ways that the environmental benefits are going to be almost an afterthought. I'm convinced of that, and I want to make that happen.
Question over here.
Yeah, one thing that bothers me a lot, one of the early graphs that you showed this enormous rise in population.
Of course.
Now,
yeah.
when Egypt built the Aswan Dam, it took them about 20 years, mm-hmm. and that interval, and they doubled the arable land in Egypt, and in the interval, the population had doubled.
Yep.
They hadn't gained a darn thing. Now, population growth has slowed somewhat. And as we educate and liberate women, it will slow more. But the earth can only deal with so much. And we have got to deal with population. It seems to me this is the basic problem of all of this stuff. Everybody wants a home. Everybody wants to feed their kids and clothe their kids and wants a better life. And that's why they cut down the rainforest, not because they want to export soybeans, because they want to feed their kid.
Yep.
And so we've got to address that. And I think this is the overlooked thing repeatedly in the economic argument, the environmental arguments.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And I think there's, you know, sometimes a desire not to talk about that by some folks because, you know, you're talking about probably the most fundamental human right there ever is in any conversation is the right to have offspring, the right to have children. We all in this room had that right. Nobody told us what size family we could have. So it does seem, you know, a little bit difficult for us to have that conversation today to say, well, maybe we have to live in a different world now, even though we never had to be limiting our family size. I'm sorry, you all have to. That's a really hard conversation, obviously. But what the good news is, the really good news is, you know, Paul Ehrlich, friend of mine, you all know his book Population Bomb, I'm sure, from the 1960s. He was the one that really raised the alarm about population issues. But back then, if you projected the population growth that we saw in the 50s and 60s, out into the 21st century, we'd be something like 15 to 18 billion people. Today, we're going to nowhere near touch over 9.5. We will never go above 9.5. And most of that difference was because of voluntary measures through empowering women, through changing the economies of the world's poor so they maybe their children would survive. We could guarantee maybe basic health care. That brought down the future population growth of the world by probably 10 billion people. That's really good. And except in the case of China, this was done basically voluntarily through democratic processes and family sizes all over the world, everywhere but China, have voluntarily, without coercion, have dramatically dropped. This is good news. And I think it's going to continue and accelerate. So I think you're right, but I also think we should be very pleased that without pointing guns at people, that we've done a pretty good job of actually letting that happen, mainly through the right processes. Status of women, education, economic empowerment, family planning, all those things. We all know the problem. We've all heard of the problems of China's one-child policy. If you look at China's population under the age of 14, in a normal biologically healthy population, there should be about equal numbers of boys and girls. Biologically speaking, there should be slightly more girls, like 50.5%. In China, you look at their age and gender distribution, there are 20 million missing Chinese girls that should be in that population that aren't. Is that what we want to do? So I think it's a very difficult question. I agree with you fundamentally. I'm not disagreeing with you, but I think there's a line where there's much we can do and make the world much better, and there's a line we cross sometimes in population that you know, far be it from me or anyone in this room to determine what is right and wrong on that, but I would like to raise that issue. It's a very difficult question. But I would emphasize the good news is we're no longer talking about $18 billion. We're talking maybe 9, and I think actually we probably won't hit 9. And then we'll be declining. Think about that. Imagine, you know, we think Social Security is going to be a problem. Wait until we start, like, depopulating the whole planet. You know, that's a problem for later. I think it's a problem we can handle, but it's going to be an interesting switch from having more older people than young people everywhere in the world, starting in about 2090, that'll start to happen, if all goes the way we think. Very interesting point. Yeah, population is crucial, and we have to think hard and long about it. Very good point.
We have a question right in front from a... Yeah.
Hi, thanks for coming out tonight. I'm really happy to see that the university throughout a lot of the disciplines is really putting a lot of emphasis on this issue this semester, especially, I'm noting.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if you could speak more about electric end-use energy as part of the answer when a lot of the energy that's through electricity is not from renewable, sustainable sources.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a really good point. Yeah, so right now, about one-third of the CO2 we produce in this country comes from generating electricity. Most of that is from burning coal. So burning coal is big, big producer of our greenhouse gases. It's a big producer of our particulate matter that causes asthma. I mean, coal's a dirty business. The good news, though, is we have a lot of it in the United States. From an energy security point of view, coal's great, and it's cheap, at least if you don't count the environmental cost. The problem is it has all these problems down the road. So there's a really big, there should be, I believe, a very large emphasis on developing not fake clean coal. We hear a lot about this. We see TV commercials, but serious research in clean coal. During the Bush administration, there were several $1 billion set aside for clean coal demonstration plants. They spent a lot of that money and then canceled the project. Why? I mean, government loves to do stuff like this. Obama's trying to raise that again to see if we can do better. But on the efficiency side of things, you know, we all know about the compact fluorescent lights, but do we all have them? I mean, they use one quarter the energy of an incandescent bulb. They last 10 times longer. And for every one you put in your house, you'll probably make about $20 to $30 at the end of the day. Show me a mutual fund right now that you put in $3 and you'll get, if you could make that your retirement plan, go for it. You know, that'd be great. And that's just a drop in the bucket. I mean, refrigerators have gotten like 5 times more efficient. You remember the old avocado green? Well, you don't, but other people here won't remember the avocado green and harvest gold. If you still have one of those, it's time to trade it in. Those would use something like 3,000 kilowatt hours a year to run a simple refrigerator. Today, the average is something like 500 kilowatt hours a year. And they're bigger fridges with more doodads and conveniences and putting the freezer on the bottom where it belongs, that kind of thing. You know, and Stephen Chu, who's the new Secretary of Energy, is a Nobel Prize-winning physicist, for crying out loud, this is unbelievable. You know, we have some really smart people in government now. This is going to be pretty interesting. Well, did I just say that? Yeah. Well, I'm from a family of Republicans. This is okay for me to say. And so this is not a partisan shot, but it's really great to have, you know, like physicists running the Department of Energy, NOAA being run by a marine biologist, Jane Lipchenko. I mean, this is good. We had some of the best scientific leaders we've had before that were probably during the Bush senior years, to be honest. So this is on both sides of the aisle, can get it right sometimes. So I'm really, really glad to see that. We could do a lot more with energy efficiency. My family, for example, back before it was sexy to be, you know, carbon neutral and all that, back in 1999, a really long time ago, we actually decided to cut our CO2 emissions as a family in half compared to other Wisconsin families to see if we could do that. We did do that. In fact, we cut our use of CO2, of fossil energy, down about 70%. And we did it, and we saved money. We made our lives more convenient. We had more time to spend, and we made money doing it. And we were, you know, pretty proud of ourselves and being a little cocky about it until I talked to a friend of mine from Germany who said, oh, congratulations, you're now like the average German or the average Swede, you know, like big deal. So there's a good news, bad news side of this. The bad news is Americans waste a huge amount of energy per capita compared to anybody on Earth. The good news is we're wasting a lot of energy that we could easily capture through really simple stuff like weatherizing. Caulk is cheap. You know, weatherize our houses, change our lighting, this actually really does add up a lot. And the stuff I was showing, you know, is vast amounts of money to be made doing this. This would be great. So we talk about it, but are we really doing it? Not enough.
So were you able to get your kids to watch the windmill go around instead of The Simpsons or something on TV?
No, working on that.
No, working on that.
Yeah, they made me buy them a Wii this winter. So.
Oh, the Wii, yeah. We've got a question over here and then to the back.
You talked about nobody really wanting to choose to live on a desolate planet, and yet I think back a few years ago to the Left Behind series of books by Tim LaHaye and his partner about these people that can hardly wait for Armageddon and when they're going to be lifted up into heaven and the rest of us are going to be left behind. And so they really don't seem to have much concern about the future of the planet, as I I understand their theme.
Yeah, I wish they would go. sorry. sometimes I speak before I think. Well, I don't know about that crowd, but I mean, you know, that's an interesting conversation to have for people who want to see the end of the world. But then on the other extreme, we see sometimes, you know, sometimes pretty rabid in friends of mine in the environmental community who are, you know, look, I don't want to go live in a cave and eat tofu by candlelight, all right? I don't think you do either. So I think the vast majority of sensible folks in America who believe in the American dream that, you know, we can sacrifice a little, work a little harder and make our children better. When did we lose that? I mean, my parents grew up in the Depression, and, you know, and a lot of you have generations that connect to that too. I mean, we had this great American dream for generation after generation that you work hard, save some, think about education and values, teach your children these things, and they'll be better off than you were. I just have a funny sense that we've lost that, and I think we can bring it back. Maybe this economic crisis is the opportunity. The good side of it is we're having conversations we haven't had in decades suddenly. Maybe this will help us restore, you know, what is really important to us as opposed to the superficial. But I really believe that the vast 90-something percent of Americans really want to do the right thing, but they want to do it in a way that's good for their family and their community, their economy, our security, and, yes, the environment. And the good news is we can, and I believe that we will. So let the fringe talk to the fringe. I'm not interested in them on either side, to be honest. Let them go.
Yeah. John, we have a question in the back here.
When people say that climate change is not real, when they challenge you in that way, and you say to them, yes, but you know, in the last 10, 20, 30 years, the Arctic ice cap is melting at an incredible rate. What's their response?
Oh, goodness.
Are they saying that there are forces beyond our control that, that what man is doing is insignificant and there are forces that are way beyond our control that we have no ability to influence? Is that what they're saying?
Well, I'll tell you the whole... It's pretty interesting you asked me that. The other day I got a phone call from the U.S. Senate. They asked me to come testify before the Environment and Public Works Committee. Amy Klobuchar happens to be on that committee to speak to this very issue. What is the scientific consensus on climate change? So I'm glad you asked me that. I'm going to have a far more hostile audience from some people in a few weeks on that. Climate skeptics really like to push three buttons that are mutually contradictory at the same time. Here's their story. One, the planet is not warming. They'll point out that, well, we have satellite data that show, in fact, the world isn't warming, that contradicts all the thermometers on Earth that show, in fact, that it is. Well, they'll tell you that, and if you don't really dig into it, you'll believe them maybe, saying, wow, that's weird. The satellites aren't seeing the warming, but the ground measurements are. Well, maybe we just don't know. What they fail to point out is that the satellites... When you put up a satellite in orbit, eventually the satellite starts to decay and kind of burn up in the atmosphere. And so if you don't account for that, they're measuring the temperature of the Earth at a lower and lower altitude and at different angles and all this kind of thing. You have to account for the satellite's little calibration. And when you do that, they show warming too. And in fact, it lines up exactly with all the ground-based measurements. So you got to destroy that myth. The world is warming. Absolutely zero doubt of that. Every shred of evidence points that it is. The second is saying, well, all right, maybe the world is warming, but we sure as heck didn't cause it. Well, really? Well, in order to believe that, you have to suspend the laws of physics. Okay? You have to believe, do you believe in the conservation of energy, yes or no? because carbon dioxide, methane, and other greenhouse gases, some of which are natural, you know, we've always had a greenhouse effect on this planet. We're just making it thicker, that's all. No, and climates have changed in the past, too. You know, there's natural things going on in our climate, no question. But when you add another blanket to your bed at night, making the atmosphere thicker and absorbing more heat and re-radiating it to the surface, guess what? It means you have to warm it up. I mean, how can you possibly tell me that you can't, you're trapping heat in our atmosphere and it doesn't warm the planet? I you know, challenge anyone to tell me what new laws of physics you believe in your universe that make that true. So then they kind of, you know, when they get somebody like me, you know, doing that, they're like, okay, maybe we're causing it. Geez, you know, all right. But the third line of attack is, so it's like, no, we're not warming. Oh, you don't believe that? Well, it is warming, but we're not causing it. Oh, you don't believe that? Well, it'll be good for us. It's okay. And because, you know, the plants will be greener, you know, Minnesota will be warmer. That won't be so bad, right? You know, they'll tell you about the CO2 in the air will make the plants grow faster and all that kind of stuff. And I say to them, really, you want to take something like 9 billion people in this century, an economy that depends on food, water, transportation, agriculture, everything, and you want to monkey with our climate? You really want to do that, huh? I mean, what did it take to put us into an economic worldwide crisis? Messing around with mortgage-backed securities that most people don't even understand, and we devastate the world's economy. Or we could play with the rainfall patterns of our planet and how we grow food. Oh, my God. I don't think we want to do that right now, do you? Or you can do it on your planet. Let you go travel on that one. So, you know, I would rather not do that experiment. I don't think it's necessarily – there'll be some things that might be better for some and a lot of things that are going to be fundamentally disrupted in ways we probably don't really understand. So, yeah, I think there's a very powerful argument. One last part of this, because I think this is really important. A lot of people get confused about the climate change thing. The last little argument that are sometimes implied, and Michael Crichton, the author of, you know, Jurassic Park, he wrote this book called The State of Fear, where he wrote this fiction where scientists and environmental groups were in a worldwide conspiracy to, you know, to have, you know, global governance and destroy the American economy or something, and global warming was that myth, that conspiracy, right? You know, when I lived in Madison, I had a neighbor, I'll call him Brian, that's his name. He won't care. He's just a regular Wisconsin boy. He drives a pickup truck, you know, regular guy. I went to high school with guys like this. Really like this. Totally solid, salt of the earth guy. You know, totally great guy. And, you know, he came out one day, and, you know, he's looking at me, and I'm getting out of my house, and I'm getting ready to go to work. And he's like, hey, John, come here. And I'm like, hey, Brian, what's up? Hey, you're a professor, aren't you? I'm like, yeah, I work down at the university. I'm like, oh, okay. You work in this environmental stuff, don't you? I'm like, yeah, actually I do. Yeah, I work in environmental issues, you know, do this and that. And he's like, hey, do you work on that climate change stuff? And I'm like, well, yeah, in fact I do. Part of the time I work on climate change issues. Yeah, and, you know, yeah, why do you ask? And he literally looked up and down the street to make sure we were alone. He leaned in and he said, can you let me in on it? I'm like, you know what, Brian? He said, no, you don't have to pretend with me. I know about it. And I'm like, know about? I'm really confused at this point. He says, you know, the big conspiracy. I'm like, Brian, what are you talking about? He says, I know you can't tell me, but I know that you guys and Greenpeace and the UN and, I don't know, Elvis or somebody are all in this big conspiracy to, you know, wreck the world's economy, to put the oil companies out of business. And, you know, I just look at him dazed and say, where did you hear this? And he says, well, on Rush Limbaugh yesterday. And he really did. And maybe it was Rush or a guest on his show, I don't know. But he heard it on Rush. And I just kind of looked at him, you know, wondering, how the heck do I answer this guy? And I finally looked at him and said, you know, Brian, do you honestly think that a bunch of liberal Birkenstock-wearing professors and environmentalists could pull it off? Do you think we could pull off a vast worldwide conspiracy that's outwitting the oil companies, international governments, and the only two people who figured it out are Rush Limbaugh and George W. Bush? Do you really believe that? And he looked at me and says, oh, my God, I never thought of that. Yeah, you guys couldn't pull it off if you tried, you know. And I also told him, like, you know, don't guess our politics. Like, you know, as I mentioned before, I'm from a long line of New England Republicans, whatever that means now. And so, you know, it's not politics. It's like just science. Show me some evidence. And the evidence says the laws of physics are being obeyed. The planet is warming. This could disrupt a lot of important things to us. We better be careful.
Ready for
Yeah. Oh, right there. Hey.
Hi.
How you doing?
Fritz, thank you very much for the talk this evening. It's very wonderful. It's easy to see why you get invited to various government groups to pitch your case and all.
Yeah, but not parties, yeah.
So, you're here.
I want to change that.
One of the things when you hear people talk about this, there's either it is given or it's implied that there's a sort of sense of urgency with all of this. And along with that sense of urgency, people think that a lot of these green companies will have to come into existence very fast.
Yeah.
And I suppose there's always a chance this stuff may actually even take off. Maybe they will come in pretty fast. Has anybody ever given any thought as to any disruptions there might be in economies when you have large numbers of workers perhaps trading off? I mean, like millions going to new jobs, but it could be faster than what we're normally used to.
Yeah, I mean, people talk about disruptive technology in a positive sense, that it's sometimes good to disrupt the economy because it creates opportunity. You know, the personal computer was an incredibly disruptive technology if you owned a cash register business, right? And, you know, eventually the automobile wasn't very good for people making buggy whips and so on. But these things happen. Many people have said this before, but, you know, the Stone Age didn't end because we ran out of stones. We create new revolutionary technologies, and that's really good for us in the long run, although it sure as heck is disruptive to some folks in certain sectors. But do we want to be held, you know, hostage by a small economic interest? You know, how many of you are chairman of large oil companies boards? You know, no. Is it in your benefit to be wasting money on oil that, you know, we could cut that in half and then start to grow our energy supplies here domestically that might create jobs and keep money in Minnesota? You know, all those that would benefit from that, you know, raise your hands, right? Probably most of us. So it can be disruptive for some and beneficial for others, and that's just the way the economy works. But let me speak to that sense of urgency. You know, I am not a tree hugger. I'm the farthest thing you'll find from a tree hugger. I started out life as a physicist and an astronomer. I'm a pretty hard-headed guy. You know, I like nature and all that, but I'm in this for people. I want to see what's, you know, I don't really care about spotted owls that much. I care a lot more about us. Hopefully we can do both. So I would really like to say, you know, that the reasons why we have a sense of urgency are because of the science. It's not just a social movement. This is a scientific problem. I hate to do the geeking out thing, but let me tell you two facts that tell you why we have to act on climate change now. One is pollution that we create from burning fossil fuels lasts a really long time. Take a gallon of gasoline, put it in a milk jug. You can hold it, put it in your hands. You can physically hold this thing. It weighs about 7 pounds, right? Put it in your car, burn it by driving about 25 miles or so on average, and you take all that carbon in the gasoline and you mix it with air in your carburetor, and it burns, producing carbon dioxide. It's carbon and two oxygen atoms. That stuff now weighs 20 pounds, believe it or not, from the original gas, because you added the oxygen in the air. So burning 1 gallon of gasoline produces 20 pounds of carbon dioxide pollution, an invisible gas that you will never see. And it goes up in the atmosphere and stays there on average for 110 years, long after you're dead. Your children are dead and your grandchildren are maybe alive, just because you drove to the mall. Now, I kind of liked our old pollution. Remember, you know, we used to ride horses. Now, that carbon, you could see that stuff. It was on the ground. So what I'd really like to see our cars in the future leave behind little carbon turds on the road. Now, that would, well, be, you know, good feedback. You know, if you can drive the Humvee along the road and then you'll boom, boom, boom. And then you drive a little Prius and it'd be like ding, ding. And you had to go out and shovel it. And, you know, that would be a good feedback. You'd see the pollution. But the problem with carbon dioxide is it's invisible. It goes up in the air. We don't see it. We pretend it's not there. And it lasts for a really long time. So what we do now will influence many, many, many centuries into the future. The second part is it takes a while for things to warm up. You're making spaghetti for dinner. You put a big pot of spaghetti on the stove, turn on the gas. Takes a little while for the water to warm up, right? 10 minutes, maybe 20, depending how big the pot is. Now make a pot of water the size of the Earth. Earth is mostly water, right? 71% oceans. The oceans are 4 miles deep on average. We're like a big pot of spaghetti. It takes the Earth about 30 to 50 years to catch up to the heat we put to it. So right now, the temperature changes we're seeing around the world today are only now catching up to the pollution of about 1969, 40 years ago on average, roughly speaking. That also means, though, that even if we stopped burning all of the oil, all of the gas, all of the coal, everything, tomorrow, our climate will continue to warm for the next 30 to 50 years, and there's nothing you can do about it. It's already programmed into the physics of this planet, and you'd have to change the laws of physics. Negotiate with God, but there's nothing else you can do. That's it. So we are on a big ship, kind of like the Titanic. Here comes the iceberg. Do we start to turn now, or do we wait a little longer? Do we wait a little longer with a system that takes 40 years to adjust, where the pollution stays there for 100 years? We're not good at long-term thinking, unfortunately, but we better as well be now. So that's why it's urgent. If we don't do something in the next 10 to 20 years, we could be literally having to redraw the Earth's maps without things like Bangladesh and Florida on them, for example. That's the real concern. That's why we have to act now.
Down a question in the back in the center here.
Yes.
Would your friend Brian be better off if we had mass media journalists who were better educated themselves about these things? If you listen to the folks on the news, commonly they get it wrong as they are trying to describe something or another. Do you have a notion about making contact with the school of journalism, for instance?
Yeah, you know, I'll tell you what I would do. Yeah, I'm terrified every time, you know, of the little bit that's in the news that I know a lot about. Like, we all probably know something really, really well that when we see it reported in typical mass media, we're horrified about how poorly it was done. But the science reporting in this country, I don't really think the problem's always the journalist. Rather than educating the journalist, I frankly would rather educate the scientist to be better communicators in the first place, to stop using jargon. My advisor's advisor, we have these weird things in the university world. He was kind of my academic grandfather. This guy had a sign on his door that I remember seeing when I started my PhD program that said, if you can't say it in plain English, you don't understand it in the first place. And if we could get our doctors and lawyers and scientists to just speak English to us and to just cut out the you-know-what, that would go a long way. Because journalists, you know, they're really hardworking, really smart people who have to cover a whole bunch of different things. They can't be an expert in this. And as newspaper circulations and local media markets dry up sometimes, it's really hard for them to have really good trained science reporters in our newspapers. There are only a few good science reporters left on the payrolls of newspapers today because they're losing money so much right now. It's really hard. So I think in Minnesota, though, we have incredible jewels. Minnesota Public Radio, unbelievably good. Minnesota Public Television, we have great public media. We have good private media. The Twin Cities is very good this way, and it's the most literate metropolitan area in the country. I think I should move here. This is good. So we're pretty blessed with that, but a lot of the rest of America isn't, and so I think there's a lot that can be done, but don't just blame the reporters and the producers. It's not just them. It's us, too.
We're in the
over
left
here, please.
Hello.
Okay. The main reason I came tonight is that there are a number of people over in Minneapolis that would like, number one, to get Minneapolis to start collecting compost, collecting it, and then we want to look into getting an anaerobic biodigester, and we need some folks from the U to get us sort of up to speed on the technology in plain English. Do you have a name?
Come talk to me afterward. I'll give you my card. You can email me. I am not an expert on this, but I will guarantee you that
people who are, right?
I will find them.
Okay, good.
I'll hunt them down. I'll get them to you.
This
is huge. I mean, you know, Sweden does this, for example. I lived there a little bit in graduate school, and, you know, I was really impressed by that. The university is doing more composting. There is actually the Metropolitan Council is looking into using new wastewater treatment facilities that are based on algae to, you know, and then use the algae as a biofuel to run. We are, in fact, very involved with that project. So there are lots of neat ideas that the Twin Cities could innovate in. But I will get you in touch with whoever it is that works on that issue.
Okay, and I have three words for people to Google. Wind source, and this is a combo, Minnesota Energy Challenge, and Everything Green Radio. Check them out.
Excellent.
Thank you. In the back, in the center here.
Yeah, in the economic crisis that we're in, we keep hearing how we just aren't buying enough stuff.
Oh.
And I'm I understand that the U.S. economy and really the global economy is based on a consumption model. And I'm wondering whether you know if there's another economic system that isn't based on taking natural resources, turning them into stuff, selling the stuff, and then putting the stuff into a landfill. That's like a dead-end, one-way street that's not really renewable.
Yeah.
And yet that just seems to be how the economy works. And I've been racking my brain to think, is there another way to do economics? And I know you're not an economist, but I was hoping you could comment.
Well, yeah, you know, I've thought about that a little, too. I think we all have in the last few months. Like, what was our economy based on again? It was based on, you know, an over consuming stuff so we to throw it away as rapidly as possible and buy another one, and speculation on it, what how people will spend their money. That was the fundamentals of our economy. I thought this country was built on, like, you know, agriculture, manufacturing, and innovation, and markets, and this kind of thing. So, yeah, I'm pretty troubled by this. I'm not an economist. I would never pretend to be one. But just as a fellow citizen and just regular person, yeah, I've scratched my head the same way. But one thing I will comment on is saying, you know, one thing we need to do is get the economics right. Let's stop pretending that we actually know the value of things. I mean, we just made this stuff up. I mean, a dollar bill is not real. It's an agreement. There's nothing physical about it. It's a piece of paper that we've agreed has a certain goods and values value, goods and services value for the rest of us. It's just an agreement. It's not tangibly, physically real. But we ignore a lot of things in our economy. We ignore, for example, in the environment. What is the true cost of gasoline, really, if you included the health and economic and environmental consequences long term? I don't know. Be more than $1.90, I'm sure. You know, what is the opportunity of doing these things? So they're actually one of the world's leading institutions on this is the University of Minnesota, right here on this campus. People like Steve Pulaski, who some of you might know. He'd be a great person to get here, by the way. He's actually a revolutionary in the idea of developing so-called environmental economics, where you put a value on ecosystems and their goods and services. What do we pay to keep a wetland so we don't have to build a wastewater treatment facility later? Or what do we pay the atmosphere for cleaning up the pollution that's in the air? Who pays the honeybees that produce 20% of our food and are disappearing all over the planet? I think they're going on strike, frankly. But, what are those worth? What is it worth to keep a little bit of rainforest, even if we have to farm next to it? What is it worth to have human rights? I mean, the economy never put a value on human rights. The economy never decided slavery was wrong. We did. And then the economy worked within that moral framework. So if we change the moral framework to say the economy should value work and true goods and services and long-term investments in our education, our social welfare, our infrastructure, our ingenuity and innovation, and the environment, markets can adjust to that, but the rules by which markets work have to be set by us. And I think that's where we've been woefully negligent as a society in the last few decades, of just taking the guardrails off the economy and letting it go wherever the heck we wanted because it was a great party while it lasted. We have to change that. And I think maybe we are now. I hope so.
Question over on the left here.
You guys have great questions here.
Wow. I have a question about, I heard a couple things.
Raise your
hand. Right here.
Right there. Oh, sorry. These lights are kind of
I heard a
me.
Couple of things on news today. One was that... two-thirds of the recyclable material from the university goes into landfill. And the other thing I heard that really startled me was that the true cost of gasoline would be in excess of $5 a gallon if we did not subsidize the oil companies. Do you have any comments on either of those?
Well, I certainly can't confirm nor deny those exact figures. I'm not aware of the... I've been here 5 months, 4 days, and a few hours so far. Not that I'm counting. I'm really happy here. But I'd urge you to contact Catherine O'Brien, who's the vice provost for facilities and our built environment. Minnesota is actually among our Big Ten peers. I can tell you a lot better than the University of Wisconsin or Michigan in terms of their sustainability programs. So if, in fact, that a lot of our recycled materials are not being recycled, somebody should know about that and okay, well, I haven't read that yet. So, yes, people should be raising hell about that and seeing what we can do. There probably is a very good reason. I think that's true of almost all municipalities, I suspect, too. I don't think the U has any different practices than, you know, St. Louis, St. Paul or Minneapolis does. But, what's truly recycled is really kind of hard to figure out sometimes. The other question about, what is the true cost of gasoline? Well, it depends what you include. Do you include Yeah, we are still, believe it or not, even though ExxonMobil posts record profits year after year after year, we are still subsidizing oil and gas exploration far more than we invest in renewable energy. Why do we do that? Well, ask your member of Congress why we do that. That's a very interesting problem. Would we have to account for the invasion of Iraq in our price of gasoline, too? That's about $1 trillion. Do you want to put that on in your car? You know, do we want to account for the fact that 150,000 people a year in the U.S. die prematurely from transportation-related pollution that wouldn't have? Do you want to pay for that in the gallon of gasoline? Where do you stop? I don't know. I'm guessing it's more than $1.90. I don't know if it's $5 or it's $50. I think it could be anywhere in between or more, depending on the true cost. Depends a lot on what you mean by true, for whom, how long, and for what. Honestly, don't know. I wouldn't believe any one figure, though. I'd view them all with a little bit of skepticism.
Well, especially if they come from an economist these days, right?
Hey, don't pick on the economist. Well, it's so easy to pick on the economist.
We've had economists here before, and we love them.
Yeah, we have a question. We love our economists.
Over on the left here.
There's a couple points I want to make. One was about when you talk about what could happen from global warming, the thing that worries me the most is when they talk about the tundra melting and methane being released from that.
Yeah.
And also they've talked about methane being released from, I think it's like ice beds underneath the Arctic Ocean.
Yeah, methane cathrates, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, and hydrates.
And that's the one where you get the runaway global warming effect. And that's, you know, from the stuff I've read, that's the most scary thing about the, you know, wanting to be urgent about it.
Yep.
Because you could get past a tipping point that it doesn't matter what we do, you know, it's going to warm to, you know, 1,000 parts per million or something like that as far as carbon dioxide. That's one point I want you to talk about. Another one is there's a technology. It's not really sophisticated, but it's very interesting. It's called agrochar, which you've probably heard about.
Oh, yeah.
And so if you could just talk about that a little bit.
Okay. Well, the first point is, you know, pretty scary scenario that you can't totally discount at all. But I wouldn't say that it's going to happen, but is it theoretically, mathematically possible? Maybe. It's the idea that if you start warming the Arctic, which we're seeing a lot of warming in the Arctic region of the world, and that's the first place global warming happens, is in the poles. We're seeing it in droves in both poles, especially the North Pole, Arctic. If you start to melt that place down, you've got a lot of carbon in peat. You've got a lot of carbon in methane in the ground. If that stuff gets released both as carbon dioxide and as methane into the atmosphere, not only do you have the global warming pollution we put in there, you get a whole lot more, kind of a bonus, from nature releasing a whole bunch of methane and CO2 that's been locked up in the ice for so long. Now we're going to liberate that, too, because we thawed out the Arctic. If that some of that could happen, and that's one of the positive feedbacks on climate change, that's why the Arctic might warm a lot more, in fact. If it happens in the really dramatic possibilities that some have indicated, this planet would look nothing like anything we've seen on this world for millions and millions of years. That would be bad. No other way to say that. And, you know, can I tell you, is that a 1% chance, a 0.1% chance, or a 10% chance? I honestly couldn't say, and nor could anyone else. Is it zero? No. Is it 100%? No. That's about it. And, you know, a lot of people say, well, you could be wrong. You might be overestimating the problems of climate change. Yes. We could also be underestimating them. That's the scientific uncertainty cuts both ways. And so far, history has told us in the last 20 years that every prediction of climate change we've made have been on the low side. The world is warming faster than anybody ever predicted. And the emissions that we're putting into the atmosphere are happening faster than any economist ever predicted. Even now, during our global recession, we're still using more energy this year than we did a couple years ago. So I'm a little worried about that. Your second point, though, on the solution side of things is the so-called biochar, agrochar. This is actually a practice that ancient Amazonian people practiced in the Amazon. The Amazon sometimes has very infertile soils because they've been rained on for millions of years and all the nutrients are washed away. So the idea is to take wood from, like, clearing a rainforest and kind of slowly burn it in the soil, what's called pyrolysis, and make kind of almost like a charcoal-like substance literally in the soil, enriching its in terms of nutrients, its ability to hold water, and the amount of organic matter in the soil, taking, like, carbon, that carbon dioxide that's put into plants, not letting it just go in the atmosphere, but locking it up in their soils. That is something that ancient people in the Amazon apparently practiced. It was discovered by archaeologists digging around Brazil, found this out, published it in Nature, of all places, in a scientific journal. And then a bunch of scientists today are saying, hey, wait a minute, we could use that to take carbon out of our atmosphere, lock it up in the soil, and enrich our soils. But whether this is economically feasible, how much labor would it take to do that? Can it be done by machine, or does it have to be done by hand like ancient peoples did? Would it work in Minnesota's soils or only in kind of very cation poor clay soils of the tropics? I'm a little bit skeptical about this because it seems like it's too good to be true. Kind of like hydrogen was, kind of like biodiesel. You know, these are not all. I'm never really believing in a silver bullet solution. Could it be one of our pieces of silver buckshot? Okay, put it on. Let's throw it in there. But you know, we've got to do more R&D. We've got to seriously invest in, you know, see if it works. Let's try it out. I hope that it does, but you know, I'm a bit skeptical that it will solve all our problems. But could it solve part of them? Maybe. Let's try it. Couldn't hurt.
John, in the back here is a question.
Yeah, I really like how you talk about how there's not a single silver bullet solution. Uh-huh. You've been talking about, it seems to me that there's almost two different ways to look at the problem. One is one of the goals of the Institute, which is to look at developing new technology, fostering ingenuity.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that we've been talking about tonight is the power of individual behavior to make changes.
Right.
And I'm thinking in my mind as you're talking about ways to put the two together so that we're developing new technology cannot just be about making an object that will make or a scientific discovery,
mm-hmm.
but it also can be coming up with different ways of encouraging or supporting changes in individual behavior on a wider basis. For example, there's been a lot of conversation in the political world about the way that now President Obama's team developed grassroots level.
Yeah.
And now they're looking at ways to use some of those resources and have that be more empowering for a way to be really energizing democracy.
Yep.
One of the things I don't know if it would be under the purview of your institute or not is to see if there are ways of developing new technologies of empowering people to make changes in their behavior. For example, one of the assets of the university is the neighborhoods that surround it.
Mm-hmm.
And what if there was some kind of partnership or something where you took...
Right.
Yeah, you know where I'm going.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. Let me try to respond to that. I guess I agree with you 1,000%, if that's even possible, because, and it's actually one of my little pet things I'd like to do someday if I ever find the time. But one of the most important innovations of the last 10 years that is fundamentally changing the world, and I don't think we understand how much, is the revolution in communication that we're seeing today. That, you know, up there with the invention of the printing press or more is the ability to communicate through, like, the Internet and other global communication systems. We are now one technological village. That has never happened in our species before, ever. We have 1.5 billion people around the world using the Internet on a daily basis, and it's growing explosively. We have something like 2.7 billion people a year using cell phones. That's extraordinary. And the digital divide we were so worried about that the world's poor would never have access to these technologies didn't happen. India, Brazil are the fastest growing markets in technology. I mean, the communications infrastructure of some of these countries makes ours look really pathetic by comparison. So this is unbelievable. We can have global conversations. So can we do things like not just, you know, for dating and shopping on the Internet, which is mainly what we use it for, but to change the world? Can we do things, I mean, you know, President Obama certainly took this into consideration in his kind of campaigning. Others, you know, the MySpace generation, the younger people who kind of live and breathe on these social networking sites, but can we do more with it? I'll give you one example that I find really very cool and kind of hopeful. The Google Foundation, the foundation arm of Google, is one of their biggest projects, is a project to use the internet, using search engines just like Google does, to look for emerging diseases, having them look for the words fever, rash, vomiting, diarrhea, whatever, in 15, 20 different languages around the world, and then use a computer to say, wait a minute, we're having a lot more of those words picking up in this part of the world than we did a week ago. And part of the work that I'm trying to get them to do is saying, and gee, that's a place that had a lot of rainfall, unusually high rain recently. Maybe they're having more mosquitoes, more malaria, that kind of thing. Anyway, Google's technology is able to detect an emerging disease like SARS or avian flu maybe about 6 months before the World Health Organization could ever do it. If you've got to wait for, in the case of SARS, the Chinese health minister to finally admit that SARS is happening in China, fly to Geneva and then officially report that to the World Health Organization and officially have it received, it's too bloody late. The only thing that travels faster than a real virus is a computer virus. So this is really good. I mean, so thank God we're going to have a surveillance system for the world's most potent killers. And it's going to be based on fundamental new kinds of communications technologies. Thank God. So I'm really applauding Google for doing that. Could we do more? Could we empower people to share solutions? I'll give you one example. The University of Minnesota's chapter of Engineers Without Borders, if you don't know about them, get to know them. They are very, very cool. They're doing work in Haiti, Uganda. They're going to be doing all sorts of interesting work. I met with them a couple weeks ago and asked them, wait a minute, you've done all these great things in Uganda, Haiti, other countries around the world. Have you shared what you've done, your designs, your project plans, and so on? Have you shared them with the world? Have you put them on the internet and open-sourced them to everybody so they could be copied and replicated everywhere? And could you get all the other universities that have an Engineers Without Borders student group to do the same thing? And they looked at me and said, well, yeah, we'd like to do that, but we need a little bit of money. I said, how much? I'm like, well, you know, $15,000. Done. I'll give you $20,000. You know, I just said, here, done, I'll do it. Just get it done in 6 months or less. And they looked at me like I was insane. I'm like, are you kidding? This is really important. You know the old bumper sticker? Think globally, act locally. That's one of the dumbest things we've ever said in some ways because there's a third line missing. Our problems are global. If all we do is act locally and we fail to connect the solutions we find in our neighborhoods and our cities with the rest of the world, we will fail. So there's a third line to that bumper sticker. We have to think globally, act locally, and then network globally again. Because the world is, things are happening so fast. We are in a race and we can't stop. We have to learn from each other, take the neighborhood and local innovations and share them around the world, use these new technologies and change the world before our very eyes. And that's one of the reasons I'm actually incredibly hopeful that the next few decades are going to be extraordinary.
We take time for, we have one more question waiting in the wings over here. So let's have that, a short question. Go ahead.
Where are we? You had talked during your presentation about having, over here.
Okay, sorry, I can't.
You talked during your presentation about having a pretty positive attitude that Minnesota can be a leader and that we have a lot ability to change this. And I'm interested in hearing more. Minnesota does have some of the best energy policies in the United States.
Absolutely.
We've got the nation's leading renewable electricity standard and more.
And the new legacy fund, we, during a recession, increased our sales tax to preserve our natural land. Who would have thought? Only in Minnesota could you pull that off.
I'd just like to hear more about what your vision is about what more we could do in this room or how you see NGOs and mm-hmm. other leaders interacting with your Institute on the Environment and yep. making this more of a community effort.
Absolutely. I'm really glad you asked that. That's really cool. You know, I came here for two reasons. One, the university is fantastic. I came from the University of Wisconsin. I'm not yet a Gopher fan. I'm working on it. But I came here. The university is very strong. But I was at another pretty strong university, too. So, you know, this was attractive. But the reason that nailed it for me was then I looked at a map and said, where else in the world can you find one of the truly great comprehensive universities that does everything, from medicine to agriculture to science, technology, law, everything, in one campus with our partners in Duluth, Crookston, Morris, and Rochester? And then within about a 20-mile radius, you have 20 Fortune 500 companies, the highest concentration Fortune 500s on Earth, by the way, more than any, you know, Silicon Valley, and companies that are incredibly philanthropic. Most of them are very good corporate citizens, and they don't compete with each other. In fact, they often collaborate. You have an incredible amount of power within 20 miles of here to do amazing things. And so you put those couple things together on top of a kind of a, I don't know what it is. I'm from Maine originally, so I come to the upper Midwest, and I'm still kind of figuring you all out after 20 years. And, you know, there's this weird kind of je ne sais quoi of, you know, of the upper Midwest, especially in Minnesota, of folks who just want to roll up their sleeves, get to work, and solve a problem and work together. And I think it's an advantage to be in the so-called flyover territory. I don't want to be in the East Coast. I don't want to be in the West Coast. I want to be in a place like this where people are going to work together, collaborate, check their egos at the door, roll up their sleeves and say, everybody's welcome. If they can pitch in, we want your help. And so our institute, I think, is going to try to take that kind of ethic, too. We want to work on global problems, find solutions for the world. There are a lot of companies here that have global reaches. We certainly have media and NGO groups that care about this. All of you, just by the fact you showed up tonight, means you are engaged citizens. You are the bedrock, people like you, of our civil society. Thank God for what you all do. I'm sure you know you are all the kinds of change agents we need, well-informed, caring citizens. And this area is just chock full of people like that. And so I wish I could give you a better answer, but I'm just saying, you know, come one, come all. Please come talk to me, email us, find our website, get involved. We're not going to be able to do everything everybody wants, that's for sure. I'll be careful what you wish for. I'm probably going to get 1,000 emails tonight. But on the other hand, you know, if one of those leads to a brilliant idea that could change the world, it's worth every second we spend on that. So, yes, I definitely want to break open the ivory tower and find ways to collaborate, but make sure we can do it in a way where we can succeed and do that together.
Well, John, what a privilege it is to we're so fortunate that you've come to the University of Minnesota, and what a privilege to have you share your expertise with us tonight. Such a plain-spoken scientist, right? It truly has been an enlightening evening. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you. Thanks.